I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a contemporary issue that has historical roots, however, and it's an issue that you see every single day around you, you hear in the news all the time, and it is electric vehicles. We're talking today about the real cost of electric vehicles. What are the advantages, disadvantages, and perhaps some unanswered and maybe even unasked questions on the issue? For that conversation, I'm joined today by Brent Bennett. Brent is policy director for Life Powered, which is an energy policy initiative of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He is also affiliated with the National Center for Energy Analytics. So we have with us today someone who spent a long time and a lot of hard work thinking through the issues of American energy policy, in particularly as connected to electric vehicles, which we see increasingly on the roads all the time, but we're going to talk about them today. Brent, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be here.
Maybe we should start with a little bit of history. Our folks love history, as you know, our listeners, and we've try to make sure we put contemporary issues in historical context. I think a lot of people, especially younger people, think, oh, electric vehicles, that means electric cars, and that means Elon Musk, and that means 2024, as though there's no history connected to this. Very often, it's easy to forget that because everything with the electric vehicle seems like it's the future. Take us back a little bit historically and talk a little bit to get us started about the history of electric vehicles.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's great to understand why we have gas vehicles, have had gas vehicles for the last 100 years instead of electric vehicles, because electric automobiles were invented around the same time as gasoline automobiles, around the time, late 1800s in the time of Edison. Edison actually had some designs for electric cars, right? The reason that gasoline became the primary fuel instead of electricity is because gasoline is a lot more energy dense than batteries. So at the time, it was especially so. I mean, gasoline had, you know, more than 1,000 times the energy density of batteries. So you couldn't drive an electric car very far back then on a single charge. But you could drive a gas car a long ways. So that was one of the fundamental, and also just the simplicity of fueling your car with gasoline versus trying to charge up a battery at the time. As battery technologies improved, that critical power to weight ratio has gotten a little better, to the point where now you can have functioning electric vehicles that have, you know, similar performance characteristics to gas vehicles and in some ways superior, right? So that's, you know, that's only now why it's taken battery technology that long to evolve to the point where you can get even close to the performance of gasoline, right?
So when did we start seeing the tipping point where battery technology became, as you say, close to a rival for the gas internal combustion engine?
The first real practical EVs, right, were in the era of the 90s, right? So you had a major project that GM and a consortium undertook to build EVs. That was the first time you really saw them kind of come on the map. But at the time, what really, you know, started to evolve more quickly was hybrids, right? And the reason is because if you think about it, a hybrid takes a much smaller battery than an EV. You can improve the fuel economy of a gas vehicle, you know, 2 to 3 times with a battery that is essentially 50 times smaller than a battery in an EV. So, you know, when the battery is really expensive and heavy, making it small to improve the, you know, fuel economy is a big deal, right? But even back then, we were still hybrids were still kind of too expensive relative to gas vehicles. Now that gap is narrowed, right? So you're seeing even without a number of subsidies that are being thrown at EVs, the federal subsidies are being thrown at EVs, which we'll get to later. Even without that much money being thrown at hybrids, you're starting to see people adopt hybrids more and more because that's the natural evolution as battery technology improves. That's a natural way to improve vehicles with a battery is to add a little battery to help improve the fuel economy and the acceleration without having to change anything else in the car. So then, it wasn't really until Tesla came along, and then we can get into this later, but and until the fuel economy regulations really started ratcheting up under Obama. So that combination of the technology and the regulatory environment was what enabled Tesla to get off the ground and eventually thrive. And it took, if we want to talk about the history of that, it's instructive. It took Tesla 15 years to achieve profitability. Most companies cannot survive that long between, startup and profitability, especially one that's as large as Tesla and spend as much money as they did. The real miracle of Tesla is that they raised capital for so long. And that's the challenge that faces anyone that wants to get into the automobile market and build electric vehicles these days, is that the time to market is incredibly long, and the time to being profitable is even longer. So
So when we're talking about electric vehicles for this conversation, you are not including hybrids in that conversation. You're talking about all electric vehicles.
right, yeah. Because yeah, hybrids are under the subsidy scheme, especially post-Inflation Reduction Act, and also under the fuel economy regulations, are treated more like gas vehicles, right? Electric vehicles kind of have their own category in terms of how they're treated within the taxonomy of the fuel economy regulations, and also the taxonomy of the federal subsidies that exist nowadays. So
So you're really only talking then when we talk about electric vehicles, about the last 10 years or so, we were talking about consumer, cars and SUVs that people buy and drive for everyday life. You're really talking about the last 10 years.
Which again, you can go back, we have 100 years of history of 100+ years of history of building electric vehicles and people trying to make it happen. And you can go back and see headlines from 100 years ago where, newspapers were saying, oh, this, electric vehicles are going to be a thing. People are going to buy them, but it never happened until recently. So that's why we only really talk about the last 10 years of it as being a, real commercial product, right?
Right. So without getting too technical, I know you know all the technology of it, but for our listeners, without getting too technical, what is the advance in battery technology that has now created this conversation and given rise to a company like Tesla?
There are really two things. First is the invention of the lithium-ion battery, right? And that, the first lithium-ion battery was commercialized in 1991 and really became, so those of us who are old enough to remember, became ubiquitous in the late 90s, right? That's when our cell phones, that's the last time we had a step change in battery technology, right? Since then, it's just been marginal improvements on that basic lithium-ion technology, right? So that was the step change, and that's what enabled Tesla's founders to start to dream of this company in the early 2000s, right? And they say, well, what if you take this cell phone battery and scale it up into a car battery? So the next real innovation, and this is really what Tesla up until recently didn't build batteries or didn't even innovate in terms of battery technology. They bought them off the shelf from Panasonic. What they did, what their fundamental innovation was to redesign the vehicle around the battery and the electric architecture, and the way that they modularize the batteries, the way they sync the batteries up with their motors and their transmission system, in a way that produces a lot better performance and is also more cost effective than the methods that the traditional automakers were using. That's what really enabled them to get off the ground. Those are it's the two, the fundamental battery chemistry, but then even as just as importantly, the way that it's packaged and engineered into the car. That's really what they, and Tesla did the second part, not the first part. So that's really the engineering marvel behind it. And then, like I said, the ability for them to market themselves and to raise money consistently. They went public in 2010. So to raise money consistently for 15 plus years until they could reach profitability. That was kind of the third thing, was their business model, right? Having to innovate in that respect. And other automakers are really struggling, especially in that third respect, to change their business models over to be able to sell, market, and sell electric vehicles in a way that's profitable.
So that, I mean, that's a very helpful setting of the context for the current discussion. I think people think they know a lot about electric vehicles, but your work, as you've said, suggests that there's some unanswered and even unasked questions about electric vehicles. What are some of the most prominent unanswered or even unasked questions about them?
Yeah, the most prominent thing is that, we know, most of us, I think, know about the $7,500 federal tax credit for electric vehicles, right? That has existed for a long time. Hybrids get, I believe it's $2,500 now. So those tax credits have existed for a long time, right? But the bigger thing is how we're driving, kind of pushing electric vehicles through the fuel economy regulations. And so, in the way the fuel economy regulations treat and favor EVs over other technologies, and that's the real, challenge that I have when I look at this issue, is as a former battery engineer, I like electric vehicles, I like what they bring to the market, but I also understand the limitations. And what I see happening from the federal government is we're trying to essentially force everyone towards that singular technology with the way that we design the fuel economy regulations. And what I mean is that it's not just the fact that we are, steeply increasing the fuel economy regulations. So starting in about 2012 under President Obama, before that we had not had any real notable increase in the fuel economy standards for over 20 years. It'd been pretty stable. And what happened was, Americans through that time, cars did become more fuel efficient, but the Americans bought bigger cars, right? So the term gas guzzler really didn't come around maybe it was around in the 70s during the oil crisis, but it really became popular in the 90s when everyone started buying SUVs, right? And so it was around 2012 that Obama really started steeply increasing the fuel economy regulation, the fuel economy standards, right? And under those standards, the weird thing is that electric vehicles are rated, at about 100 miles per gallon ish. They all vary, but that's about the average. And your fuel economy standard is, now in the 40s, right? So what happens is if you're an automaker and you're selling EVs like Tesla is, for example, they get essentially 60-ish credits that they get to sell to other automakers who are not meeting the standard, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work. So it's essentially a wealth transfer, right? So if you're buying electric vehicles, you get to sell the credits, right? Makes sense, because that way, there's more liquidity in the market. Each automaker can has another way to meet the standard other than having to, build more fuel efficient vehicles. So you can have some like Tesla that are good at that can sell credits to automakers who are still trying to catch up to that, right? So there's this wealth transfer that exists, right? The problem is that we don't actually give EVs 100, that we rate them, we don't rate them in the fuel economy taxonomy. We rate them not at 100 miles per gallon, but at over 600 miles per gallon. The reason is that back in the 90s, we created a law that added a multiplier to the fuel economy standard, to the fuel economy for alternative fuel vehicles, right? Now the law specifies a lot of fuels like methanol and other, natural gas and other things, right? But it actually doesn't specify electricity. They had included electricity at one point and then took it out of the law, and it wasn't meant for this particular taxonomy to apply to electric vehicles. But the Department of Energy, starting in the year 2000, started doing that. And so they applied this it's over 6x multiplier to the fuel economy of electric vehicles. And that has existed to this day. It was actually just extended for a few years last month. And it's fake. It's totally fake, right? The electric vehicles, the rated fuel economy, according to the methodology of the EPA, is about 100 miles per gallon, right? But we're giving them an immense amount more credits. And so That means
So then
that,
what's happening with those immense credits that
right.
EV
So that,
nations
so
are
yeah.
generating?
So if you build an EV, then you get, instead of, 60-ish credits, you're getting basically 600. You're getting 10 times as many credits that you can sell. So it amounts to a huge favoritism toward EVs within the taxonomy, right? So if you think about it, if you're building a hybrid vehicle that gets, 70 miles to the gallon, right? Well, shoot, you don't get that multiplier because you're not running in an alternative fuel, you're still running on gasoline. So that you only get that many credits. So it amounts to, probably into the tens of thousands of dollars per EV, this kind of subsidy, because you're essentially saying, the value of those credits, right, for each EV I build is worth well over $10,000 by our estimation. So
So then
it's a challenge. Yeah.
I was going to say, so
So
then does a car manufacturer like Tesla actually sell those enormous credits to General Motors or Ford or somebody?
Yeah, they do. So yeah, it's all bilateral transactions. There's no market for this. It's just all done bilaterally. And since Tesla right now is still about two-thirds of the American electric car market, they're generating the most, right? But you also, within each car company, right, you can essentially transfer those credits across your balance sheet, right? If you're a Ford or GM, you might be generating those credits through your EV unit, and then you're using that to balance off the lack of credits that you generate, the deficit that you're generating from selling trucks, for
Right.
example, right?
So am I right to draw this? I'm just thinking now about what you're saying. It's kind of amazing. Perhaps unintended consequence would be that you might have some manufacturers who want to make more or believe there's a demand for more hybrids, for example, which you were talking about. But because they don't get the six times credit, they can make electric vehicles, sell fewer of those, but get way more credits to transfer. And it's almost a disincentive to either increase fuel efficiency in internal combustion engines or produce more hybrids.
That's exactly right. Yes. And that's actually why the environmental groups petitioned the Department of Energy to drop this multiplier. They did that over a year ago. And the original idea was that it wouldn't. The automakers lobbied against that because they effectively said that we can't meet the fuel economy standards unless we get an insane amount of credits for electric vehicles like this. We're not going to meet it just by improving the rate of increase is so steep that we're not going to meet it just by selling more fuel efficient gas vehicles and hybrids.
So is one consequence, a thing about unanswered questions or unintended consequences, is one consequence of the federal regulations being so skewed toward electric vehicles that we are artificially dampening supply or demand for hybrid vehicles, for example?
Yeah, because if you want to buy a fuel efficient vehicle, the hybrid is not getting, tens of thousands of dollars or, 10 to 20,000 at least of credits, right? So the automaker can't discount the price of it accordingly, right? It has to sell it for essentially what their production cost is plus some margin. So that's essentially what's happening. And furthermore, what's happening is, as we sell more and more electric vehicles, the actual fuel economy of our auto fleet is not improving as much as the standards, right, that are out there. The real world fuel economy falls far, far below the standards, and that gap is widening the more that we do this, right? So it's already the real world fuel economy of our fleet is in the mid 30s. It's almost 10 miles per gallon behind the standard, and gap's going to grow because we're even even with EVs are still only 10% of the market, right? So of the new car market. So even if they grow to 20, 30%, it's not going to make a big dent in the actual real world fuel economy of the fleet.
For people,
You
like,
know, whereas
what about these other?
if we sold a lot more hybrids, it might do more than that, right? It might do more to impact that.
Yeah, right. Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Right. What about this other consequence or possible unintended consequence, which is you said that the EV's real rating by the EPA is 100 miles per gallon. Well, that's per gallon of gasoline, of course. But EVs obviously draw their power from electricity. Are there ratings for vehicles about energy per mile? So for example, electricity doesn't just happen, it has to be generated. And have there been any studies that show how much electric vehicles, how much energy they use per mile versus the internal combustion engine or versus a hybrid?
Yeah, well, that's actually how they do that calculation, is they do it on an energy equivalent basis. So they say, okay, here's how much energy the electric vehicle consumes to go 100 miles.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And the reason that electric vehicles get that higher rating is because, even though they're heavier, is because the consumption of energy from a battery through an electric motor into the wheels is a lot more efficient than combusting gasoline to, you know, produce energy to drive the wheels, right? So that the combustion of gasoline is less than 20% energy efficient, right? Electric vehicles are well over 50. So that's the amount of energy that's in your battery that actually goes into moving your car, right? So that's the reason that they get that higher fuel economy, is because it's exactly an energy equivalent basis, right? But it's kind of, even to put EVs into the same kind of regime as gas vehicles is kind of odd if you think about it, right? Because you're consuming an entirely different fuel. Really, what you're consuming is whatever is being used to make the electricity. And that's not gasoline. That's either natural gas, coal, and sometimes nuclear, and then, you know, odds and ends, wind and solar, hydro, whatever, right? So whatever the mix of your electric grid is, that's the fuel that you're actually consuming, not gasoline. But we have, you know, lumped, because electric vehicles are vehicles, we have lumped them into this taxonomy that's not designed for them at all, right? When we built out the fuel economy standards in the 1970s, electric vehicles were not even an afterthought of being part of that, right?
So what are some other, in your research that you've discovered following along that conversation, what are some other unanswered or unasked questions about EVs?
We all know the reason that EVs are being pushed nowadays is for emissions benefits, right? That's the idea, right? We're not pushing them for, you know, land use benefits, right? Because it takes a lot of land to mine lithium, to process all the materials that make a battery. It's to, you know, provide the electricity too for it, right? So it's what's the environmental benefit of EVs? It's, well, there's no emissions at the tailpipe, right? The challenge is that, you know, if we're talking about either carbon emissions or we're talking about emissions of like actual pollutants like soot and smog, EVs don't do a whole lot in either case. First of all, on the issue of soot and smog, you know, we've reduced our levels of pollution since the 1970s by more than 80% in U.S. cities. So we already, and the amazing thing about COVID, and I wrote a paper on this back during COVID 4 years ago, we took half the cars off the road and the pollution levels in our cities barely changed. It's because we're already so close to natural.
That's interesting. That's counterintuitive.
Right, isn't it? You know, but it's because, well, there are natural sources of soot and smog, right? Of particulate matter and ozone are the technical terms for those. So they're natural sources. And a lot of times the levels depend upon weather, right, in your city. Our emissions are only part of that, less than 50% at this point. So when you take, say, our emissions are less than 50% of the level, determining the level of pollution in your city, and then, you know, cars are a portion of that, and then you take half the cars off the road, okay, you're only getting a small difference in emissions that's actually, and that difference is far outweighed by the natural variations primarily caused by weather. So you saw in some cities, pollution levels dropped, and some cities it actually increased during that time. It was all because of weather patterns. And there's very little across that noise, the signal was very small. and so we already ran this experiment. And so we see that, you know, electric vehicles are not going to do a whole lot to improve pollution levels, right? Because we're already so low. Now, in a place like China that has a lot higher pollution levels, that might make more of a difference, right? Because human emissions are a much bigger part of the picture for them, but not for us. The other thing is carbon emissions, right? So carbon emissions depend heavily upon how the battery is made, because there's a lot more embodied emissions. There's a lot of energy it takes to make a battery. a lot more so than the energy it takes to build the components of a standard gas vehicle, right? So the embodied emissions are higher. You have to make up for that over time by drawing electricity from an electric grid that has very low carbon emissions. So it's actually, it kind of depends on where you are as to whether EVs produce, on the whole, fewer carbon emissions over a 10-year life, or sometimes even more if you're on a high carbon grid.
So wait, that's a very interesting point. So you're saying that creating the car, creating the electric vehicle, there's many more carbon emissions than creating the internal combustion vehicle.
Right. Yeah. Because there's so much.
Is it a multiplier? Is it, you know, 25% more, or is it way more?
Again, it depends on where and how you make it, but a lot of times I would say it's about 50% more. So you might, 50 to 100%. Now that's only maybe, 20 to 25% of the lifetime emissions of the car is the energy it takes to make the car. But it's something that over time, if you're not charging that EV on a low carbon grid, so say the emissions that it takes to make the electricity are only half the carbon emissions of a gas car, then you're kind of in that range where over 10 years, that EV is not really going to make a big difference in terms of carbon emissions. Even, for example, on a almost zero carbon grid, Norway is a great example of this, because they, in Norway, almost more than half now of new car sales in Norway are EVs. They have done even more than we have to subsidize and push people to drive EVs. But because of driving patterns, and because of just the fact that people are still use their gas cars for like their longer trips, and their carbon emissions have barely budged, because in that case, that kind of gets away from what we were just talking about. But it just, even if you have a low carbon grid, if you're not using the EVs to displace all of your driving, right? Then that has very little effect on your overall carbon emission, because transportation is only about a third of our 30% of our emissions, right? So if you don't use EVs to substitute a big part of that, then you're talking about a very small difference in emissions, right? On top of the fact that that's if you're using the EV in a way that produces very little emissions. You know what I mean? So it's hard math to get to where this actually. It's hard to say this actually is making a big difference on the emissions environment as a whole, right, globally.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting, because sometimes people think, they just think about EVs and emissions in terms of starting your car and driving it, as opposed to the process that goes on before and then after the whole process, which of course is the full account of emissions and pollution.
Yeah, and transportation emissions, light duty vehicles are less than half of our transportation emissions, and most of it is, you know, cargo transportation, trains, airplanes, ships. That's more than a majority. So, you know, we haven't found ways to electrify those forms of transportation yet. So even as we see more and more people adopting, you might think like, oh, like in my neighborhood of 80 people, there's 12 people that have Teslas. Wow. So if we all start driving those to work, that makes a big difference. Well, not exactly, you know.
So if you're thinking about important reforms, and obviously you've studied the policy implications of electric vehicles. If you're thinking about important reforms so that the American public can have a clear understanding and a true accounting of the costs and benefits of electric vehicles. What are some of the most important reforms that you think America should adopt?
Now, well, first of all, we have to treat EVs honestly under the fuel economy standards. And to a certain extent, we should probably, and like I said before, try and come up with some new taxonomy for them to say, like, okay, what are the real benefits? It's almost more honest to try and go through, you know, because as we're changing the fuel economy standards, the Environmental Protection Agency is also changing the emission standards, right, for setting greenhouse gas emission standards on vehicles. It's more honest, really, to do it that way, because you're, if that's what you're, the reason nowadays that we're pushing EVs is for the apparent environmental benefits and not because
it's not really for fuel conservation in and of itself, right?
Right. You know, it's yeah. I mean, you can say, well, we're diversifying. I guess there's a benefit to diversifying the fuel consumption, right? But you know, nowadays we're a net exporter of petroleum. So it's a very different environment from the 1970s now, right? So
what would it mean?
So
example,
you have to tie, you know, if we're going to push EVs through the regulatory environment, we have to tie that to what are the actual benefits, right? And so getting rid of this fake multiplier is one thing, but then also beyond that is tying, you know, what are the actual benefits of EVs relative to gas vehicles, and is that worthy of, you know, some kind of different treatment under the federal regulatory standards, right?
All right. So, for example, what about for the tax code?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, the tax code, the $7,500 tax credit, right, is that exists. You know, that's to us is, you know, more, you know, smaller government people not in favor of subsidies. That's automatically just a weird thing to do, right? To say that we're just going to subsidize EVs because they're EVs. You know, okay, what's the benefit you're getting from that, right? I mean, it's kind of this ephemeral idea again that somehow there's a big environmental benefit, and so we just throw a number out there, $7,500, and somehow that quantifies it, right? But we're already doing that through the greenhouse gas emission standards and the fuel economy standards, right? Those are the supposed benefits, right? So why do we have this tax credit over here that exists for what, you know? What's the purpose of that? You think like there's almost this ideology around somehow we need to use every tool we have to push EVs when there's not really consideration of costs and benefits, right?
Are there any other reforms that you think we ought to implement, again, to give the American public a fuller understanding of the costs and benefits of electric vehicles?
Yeah, I think that if we're going to have the fuel economy standards, even supposing we fix this multiplier, right, and we start actually accounting them properly, we still need to have transparency, right? So when I say, you know, the credits are worth, you know, north of $10,000, $20,000 per EV, well, that's a guess because there's no information on that. We don't track the value of these credits, what they're being sold for. There needs to be some transparency here. For example, the production and investment tax credits for wind and solar, I can go to the Office of Management and Budget website in 5 minutes and have how much we gave out in tax credits last year. You know, those numbers are tracked and we know exactly what it is. This is a really hidden subsidy. We don't know, you know. So there needs to be some transparency. We're pushing for that right now. That's one of, you know, kind of something that we're trying to do is to get Congress to investigate and say, look, you know, we need to know the value of this because this is, you know, already spending in the tens of billions per year on this, you know, this wealth transfer, right? So if we're going to have more and more electric vehicles, then how much are we actually spending?
So it strikes me based on what you said before, which is environmental groups also agree with you that the exaggerated multiplier is not helpful in their view. Has this issue made strange bedfellows, so to speak, where you have groups across the spectrum arguing in favor of getting rid of the multiplier or arguing in favor of transparency in the selling of the credits from the multiplier?
Yeah, a little bit. The big difference, of course, is that you know, they want to do that while continuing to push the fuel economy regulations even higher, right? So which which is still going to force a lot of automakers to, you know, to build more EVs, right? Because that's the thing, you have to, if you don't get as many credits per EV, you're gonna have to build a lot more of them. And so that, to from our perspective, you need to, you know, get rid of this multiplier and then actually make the fuel economy, you're gonna have to slow down the rate of increase in the fuel economy regulations to make it actually realistic to achieve. Otherwise, we're going to just bankrupt the auto industry. I think that's what the automaker, I get what the automakers are saying. They're saying, if you're going to increase the fuel economy regulations this much, you're going to bankrupt us unless we get some kind of, you know, benefit over here, some subsidy. So that's how this has come about. And so I think that's, you know, yeah. So I think I would say that, you know, we agree that the math needs to be real. I would agree with the environmental groups. Where I disagree is that if we're going to do that, if we're going to invoke, you know, real math here, we have to also make real the fuel economy regulations and not just arbitrarily keep increasing them at a rate that the automakers cannot meet.
All right. When you look to the future, for the next 10 years, let's say even 20 years out, what do you think the future is for electric vehicles in the United States?
I'm an optimist in terms of the growth of that market. The challenge, because there's a big addressable market there, right? You're talking about, for example, I drove to work today. I drove about 7-8 miles. So I drive about 15 miles a day, right? For me, an electric vehicle makes a lot of sense because that's mostly what I drive. Now, I might still keep a lot of my neighbors have EVs because they do the same thing, but they also all have a gas car as well. I don't know of a single person who only has electric vehicles at this point in time. So there's a big addressable market there, but to say that we're all going to drive EVs and use them for all purposes is a big stretch, because then you're talking about, you know, to do long road trips, you need charging infrastructure and you need better fast charging. Well, those things are very slow to develop. So I see that, you know, the light duty passenger car market, I think there's a lot of room for growth for EVs there. But getting into, and if we can talk about battery technology, if you want, the limitations of battery technology, but there are physical limits to getting the power to rate ratio down to make it practical for trucks, first of all, but then, you know, trains and ships and especially airplanes.
Well, that's very helpful for us to think through on this issue. As you've said, there's a lot of people saying things that aren't necessarily scientifically grounded or grounded in a thorough analysis of cost and benefit when we think about EV. This has been very helpful for us to get to understand some of the issues that we need to know as the American public to sort this out. Brett Bennett, thank you for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.